Today at Reader's Corner, John Thavis, author of The Vatican Diaries, a behind-the-scenes look at the power, personalities, and politics at the heart of the Catholic Church.
Pope Benedict was a rational man, and I think he realized resignation is something the Church needs to have there as an active option. The Church has, of course, a number of great challenges, and one of them is the shortage of priests and the shortage of other ministers in some parts of the world. What the Church does and its whole focus is going to move beyond Sunday Mass and into the real lives of Catholic people. And that's where I think Pope Francis sees the Church's major activity.
I'm Bob Custer, president of Boise State University. Welcome to Reader's Corner. For John Thavis, the timing couldn't have been better. His book, The Vatican Diaries, a behind-the-scenes look at the power, personalities, and politics at the heart of the Catholic Church, was released in February 2013, just as Pope Benedict XVI announced he would be the first pope in 600 years to resign. It was a stroke of luck that put his book, the culmination of nearly 30 years as a journalist covering the Vatican, in exactly the right place at the right time. As the former Rome bureau chief for Catholic News Service, few understand the inner workings of the seat of Roman Catholicism better than Mr. Thavis. His book reveals that Vatican City's public image of power, hierarchical authority, and reverence for the past often masks an uncertain and inept organizational culture. Today we're featuring an encore edition of our interview with John Thavis. A paperback edition of the Vatican Diaries was recently released with a new afterword about Pope Francis. Mr. Thavis joined Catholic News Service as a reporter in 1983 and became Rome bureau chief in 1996. He served 3 years as president of the Association of International Journalists accredited to the Vatican, the only American ever elected to that position, and has won numerous awards for his work. Last year, Mr. Thavis retired from Catholic News Service and moved back to the United States. He travels frequently to Rome, continues to cover Vatican affairs, and lectures in the United States and Europe. Mr. Thavis joined us by phone for this interview. John Thavis, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Well, thanks for having me, Bob.
So, John, did you have any idea as you're finishing this book, and I don't know how many days or weeks or months it was when Pope Benedict made his grand announcement, but by the time I got to the last chapter of your book, and especially the last chapter, because the last chapter really does make it clear Pope Benedict was really uncomfortable in so many aspects of the Pope's role, especially the one dealing with external constituencies and being out meeting and greeting the crowds. As you point out, he was an academic and a scholar. So was there anything, since it hasn't happened in 600 years, I can understand that there wouldn't be, was there anything where you're thinking, wow, you know, this guy could step down?
Well, in fact, there was. I agree with you, actually, rereading that last chapter. There's a tone in it that when I was writing it, I wasn't actually aware of it, but rereading it, I saw that there's a kind of discouraging tone and a frustrating tone. This was a pope who really did not feel comfortable in the job, and as the years went on, I think he felt that his message was not really getting across to the right audiences, and partly because he was sometimes not well served by his own top aides, and I think this really weighed on him. When I read that last chapter after he announced his intent to resign, I realized probably the only thing I had to write to update it was, and so he resigned. So it wasn't a complete surprise to me. I actually had been tracking Pope Benedict from Minnesota. I retired as bureau chief in Rome about a year ago, and I had been tracking very carefully what Pope Benedict was and wasn't doing, in part because I had a book coming out in February. And I realized that if the Pope were to resign, that it might affect the release of this book. If he resigned too early, of course, I might have to update it. If he resigned right as the book was coming out, I realized that's considered the perfect storm in publishing. All attention is on the Vatican, and in fact, that's what happened. My publisher is convinced I went to Rome in February and convinced the Pope to resign. I keep telling her that isn't true. However, I did go to Rome on February 10th, and I walked into the Vatican press office the next morning, just in time to hear the Pope resigning. And my journalistic colleagues, who hadn't seen me in a year, looked at me very suspiciously. and said, "What are you doing here?" You must have known. Well, the fact is I didn't know, but there were enough signs to make me think perhaps he was considering this move, because there really was nothing on his calendar. He had recently named new cardinals. He appeared to be topping up for a conclave. And the Pope had quite openly spoken about the possibility of resignation in a book 2 years earlier, when he said it could be the duty as well as the right of a pope to resign in certain circumstances. So I think he wanted to do this, and I think he wanted to set a precedent. And, you know, coming from a very traditional-minded pope, it was a remarkable gesture, I think.
And it just might well be that it would end up taking a scholar or an academic who can take a slightly more detached view of the papacy to come up with this idea of a pope resigning.
Well, you're exactly right. When Pope Benedict was elected, he said something that struck me as a little odd. He said, "This will not be a long pontificate." Well,
really?
I think he had in mind from day one the idea that he might resign. And I think it's because, in part, he saw Pope John Paul II, who was pope for 26 years, but many of those years not in good health. And I think while most Catholics, he appreciated the fact that the pope was suffering and that this was a valuable witness to the world, I think he also recognized that you cannot demand from God that he keep a pope, you know, in relative good health to the very end. And with Pope John Paul II, the church was fortunate that actually he was at his window greeting people a week before he died. But I think Pope Benedict realized that isn't necessarily the case, that a pope can have a stroke, he can be moribund, he can be forced to disappear for months or even years. And Pope Benedict was very much a rational man, not a mystic like John Paul II. And I think he realized that I'm going to do this in the most reasonable way. And resignation is something that the church really needs to have there as an active option.
So my recollection is that there were some rumors floating immediately upon his resignation, that there was a reason for this resignation, that there was a scandal brewing, that something went very wrong, that he was implicated. None of that probably true, given this approach to his resignation?
Well, the Pope resigned. Actually, he didn't have any serious illness that we know of. He simply said, "I don't have the energy to do this job well anymore." And again, I think on Pope Benedict's part, that was deliberate. I think he wanted to show that the office of the papacy can be set aside, not necessarily when a pope is on his deathbed, but when a pope truly feels that the demands of the office are too great for his energy level. And I think in doing that, he really liberated the church in a great way. However, journalists being journalists love to find, you know, hidden motives, and Italians especially are really good at inventing scenarios for what was really behind the Pope's decision. And, you know, there had been rumors of scandals and power struggles in the Vatican. Well, those were rather blown up beyond recognition immediately after the Pope announced his intention to resign. I think truly that it was exactly as Pope Benedict said. He felt that he did not have the energy to carry out this job well anymore. And part of that may have been, as I say, the frustration at not being well served by some Vatican officials, or even at seeing his own butler leak his confidential documents. I mean, I'm sure Pope Benedict was a very sensitive man, and that hurt him, and it probably added to the psychological burden he was carrying.
You mentioned the top aides a couple of times. Does a new pope have the opportunity to bring his own staff? I certainly get the impression from your book that popes inherit the Vatican bureaucracy all the way up to the closest people around the pope. How does this really work?
Well, in fact, you're right. Popes tend to come in and want to reassure the Roman Curia, which is the Vatican's bureaucracy, that don't worry, I'm not going to revolutionize things. And that's what the Roman Curia wants to hear, of course. In fact, the last two popes have confirmed all top officials in their jobs for several years. Well, that can be a good thing, again, for the sake of continuity. But what if you want to initiate some bold changes? You know, then it's not a good thing. And one thing Pope Francis has done that I think is truly needed in the church is that he's put the top officials on guard. He said, you will remain in office until I make my appointments, and I do intend to make my own appointments. So I think they all pretty much know that they have no job guarantee right now and that they should be looking around for something else to do. That's unusual for popes to come in and shake things up, but I think Pope Francis feels he has a mandate to do that.
And does the fact that Pope Francis is from South America, does this help when it comes to reforming the Vatican?
I think it does. He's an outsider. He's an outsider in many ways.
He's a Jesuit, for one thing. That'll make him an outsider.
He's a Jesuit, kind of an ultimate outsider to power structures. He's a Latin American. He's someone who rarely came to Rome. I mean, there are bishops and cardinals in this country, for example, who are over in Rome almost every other week. We would see them quite often. And I would often wonder, gee, I wonder if they ever stick around in their home archdiocese. As Cardinal Bergoglio, he did not travel much, and the reason was he thought it was a waste of money. In fact, when he was elected pope, he rather famously sent word back to Catholics in Buenos Aires telling them, look, it's going to cost a lot of money to come over for my inaugural mass. Save it and give some money to the poor instead. So he is an outsider. He does not really know the Roman Curia very well. This can be good and bad. It can be good because he doesn't really owe anybody anything. He doesn't have the kind of debts that you tend to build up when you're active in a bureaucracy. But it can be bad because he's going to need help navigating those waters. He needs to know if he's going to streamline offices or combine offices or simply make big changes. He needs to know what those offices do and where are the most efficient people and where are the most incompetent people.
You're listening to John Thavis. He's the author of The Vatican Diaries, a behind-the-scenes look at the power, personalities, and politics at the heart of the Catholic Church. I get the impression from reading your book that the Pope is not the CEO that we normally think of in the chief executive officer, whether you're looking at business, whether you're looking at education, whether you're looking at health care, hospitals. CEOs come in and they take over and they drill down and they make decisions that can literally turn a company around, maybe not overnight. As I read this book about this Pope and those who came before him, you just get the impression that this Vatican bureaucracy is so impermeable that there's no way to turn it around.
Well, it's very difficult. Yeah. And popes have discovered that sometimes to their regret that they have expended a lot of energy on trying to reform the Roman Curia and never gotten anywhere. There's too much resistance. Pope John Paul II spent about 15 years on a project of reforming the Vatican and essentially gave up on major reforms. And I think Pope Benedict came into the office and realized, you know, I'm 78 at the age when he was elected, and I don't have the resources to give to reforming this Roman Curia. That's not going to be a priority for me. And I think he just wrote it off. It is difficult for several reasons. One is that the Roman bureaucracy, the Vatican bureaucracy, has developed and grown by accretion so that you don't have a real organic bureaucracy like you do in, say, a major corporation where you actually have the CEO and his orders are carried out kind of right down the line. At the Vatican, you have about 100, 150 different organisms that have popped up over the centuries, and they all have their own history, they have their own turf, and they believe they have their own, to a limited extent, their own authority. So it's not like one office answers to an office directly above it, which answers in turn to an office directly above that. That's why it's very hard to coordinate Vatican activities, and it's hard to streamline them.
And that's what you call the caricature of power? Is that basically its definition right there?
I call it a caricature because I think most people in this country and in other countries assume the Vatican is run like a major corporation, the Pope at the top, and what the Pope says goes, and everything's carried out in lockstep, and secrets are never revealed, and they're all on the same page carrying out the same agenda. And, you know, that is not the Vatican I know. So, yes, I think also people have an impression, an image that is a caricature in terms of wealth and power. The Vatican is considered to be a wealthy institution. I happen to know that it's cash poor, for example. Its budget is about $330 million a year, and that is not very much when you're considering that it has almost 4,000 employees. That's a budget that's smaller than most major universities in this country. It has holdings, of course, in real estate and in art, but these are holdings that are not easily converted into cash, and so it's always got its begging cup out.
So, John, compare your role as a reporter for the Catholic News Service covering the Vatican when it comes to access to the access a member of the White House press corps would have. How did your job differ, or how much was it alike that you might find in the White House?
Well, I've never covered the White House, but I have a pretty good idea, having talked with people who have. It's quite different. Number one, when you're covering the White House, you're covering politics in Washington. There are two political parties. You're always going to find someone who is willing to, say, critique the party in power, or someone who is willing to slip you some information because it advances their political agenda. That's not the case necessarily at the Vatican. You know, there are no real political parties, and most Vatican officials in general are not real enthusiastic about talking to reporters. So you have to create your own channels of communication, and that means essentially showing an interest, showing a sense of fairness in covering the Vatican, and spending time cultivating sources. Most journalists who cover the Vatican do so on a part-time basis. They're busy covering Italian politics, the latest escapades of Berlusconi, war in the Middle East. They're sent all over. We had the luxury at Catholic News Service of having three full-time correspondents covering exclusively the Vatican. And that meant we could invest the time in cultivating sources. I think probably by the time I left after 30 years, I had between 300 and 400 sources I could call to help me with a story. And that, by helping me with a story, I mean, oftentimes it's a matter of the Vatican makes a statement or puts out a document, and it's unclear what the significance is. You need help kind of reading and understanding these things. And we found generally that sources were quite helpful, oftentimes off the record, because they're not supposed to talk to journalists without approval of their supervisor. But essentially, it is standard journalism at work, but in a very concentrated way, I would say.
You write about a priest by the name of Father Delgado, I believe is the way it's pronounced, but I could be wrong about that. And this is a situation where you credit Pope Benedict for his action in this case, and you can explain briefly what the background of this is. What I was wondering about, given the fact that you also say he was a favorite of Benedict's predecessor, Pope John Paul II, given all this guy did, how could this have escaped Pope John Paul II's personal knowledge base, and what's that say?
Well, this is a very painful question for people to face, because it's a case that is not only embarrassing, but it casts a shadow on Pope John Paul II. We're talking about Father Marcial Maciel Delgado, who was the founder of the Legionaries of Christ, which the Church considered its most successful religious order of the late 20th century. He was found to be a pedophile, and not only a pedophile, but a man who had established kind of false personalities around the world. He was found to have fathered children. He had two wives living in other parts of the world. Just an incredible case. And to Benedict's credit, when he was Cardinal Ratzinger in the final days of Pope John Paul II, he reopened the Vatican's investigation of this priest and said to investigators, go and interview the victims. He didn't want this case lingering on his shelf. He wanted to go after this guy. As Pope Benedict, however, it took him several years before the Vatican finally put out a statement saying, yes, this man was despicable. Unfortunately, by that time, Father Maciel was already dead and buried, and critics, I think justifiably, said the Vatican moved too slowly. So while Benedict deserves some credit for moving on this, he did not do so with a sense of urgency, and I think a lot of people will not forgive him for that. But it definitely raises a question for Pope John Paul II. Why was Pope John Paul II standing with this priest a year before the Pope's death, praising him to the skies? I think probably that the Polish Pope was not fully informed of the accusations, and I think part of the reason for that was that in his waning years, the Pope really was not very well, and I think the people around him closed him off and isolated him and made sure that some bad news never reached his ears.
You also point out that Pope Benedict's first major publication as pontiff was to ban homosexuals from the priesthood, and you write about this extensively in one of the chapters. I wonder if you could just sum up for us the background on how this came to be.
Well, this is a highly controversial document, and in fact, it was one of the stories I managed to break while covering the Vatican, that a Vatican office was working on a document that would say, if you're gay, you cannot be a priest. It was controversial because, of course, number one, even Vatican officials who looked around at the priesthood recognized that there are gay men who are priests and who are perfectly good priests. And number two, a lot of Vatican officials wondered, well, if you start eliminating homosexuality as a factor for admission to the seminary, how are you going to determine that? And they were very much afraid that psychological testing was going to become the final arbiter of who could become a priest. Nevertheless, Pope Benedict, as Cardinal Ratzinger, pushed this document, and in the end, the document was issued in his, I believe, his first year as Pope. It was also Pope Benedict, as Cardinal Ratzinger, who inserted into the Catechism of the Catholic Church the wording about the Church's teaching on homosexuality, describing it as disordered. And I think this is significant. I think Pope Benedict wanted this to be enshrined in the Catechism, and I think it's going to be hard for a future pope to undo that.
You're listening to John Favis. He is the author of The Vatican Diaries, a behind-the-scenes look at the power, personalities, and politics at the heart of the Catholic Church. Pope Francis, coming from South America, certainly will be a pope who understands the rising influence of South America in the Catholic Church, and one could say the same about Africa. But you also mentioned earlier that this is a church that is cash poor. What will the challenges of the Catholic Church be in the future when it comes to serving these ministries that are growing in number, and also dealing, of course, with older ministries like those in the United States and especially Western Europe, where the numbers are falling off precipitously?
Well, the church has, of course, a number of great challenges, and one of them is the shortage of priests and the shortage of other ministers in some parts of the world. Now, the Vatican doesn't like to use the word shortage. It believes that as long as you distribute priests around, there will always be enough priests. It's just that lay people might have to pick up the slack every now and then. But the Vatican has also been very clear that there are certain things it does not believe lay people can do. And so it's a dilemma. I think certainly the church has to look at how to inspire vocations. Secondly, it has to look probably at the question of priestly celibacy. And this is an issue where there are legitimate differences, but there's certainly a possibility for action, because although very few people realize this, it's not broadcast from the rooftops, the Catholic Church does have married priests. It has married priests in its Eastern rites. It has some married priests among the Anglicans who have come over into the Catholic Church. And so it's an issue on which there could be movement. In fact, we have a new pope, Pope Francis, who, as a cardinal, said that we could take a new look at this because, as he put it, it is a disciplinary question, not a doctrinal question. So the church can make a change there. And I think the bigger change the church can make is moving away from clericalism. And here, too, we have the new pope, who has spoken very strongly against clericalism, the idea being that he wants lay Catholics to take a bigger role in what the church does. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that lay Catholics are going to be up there on the altar or giving sermons. I think what it means is that what the church does and its whole focus is going to move out of the boundaries of the actual churches, in other words, beyond Sunday Mass, and into the real lives of Catholic people. And that's where I think Pope Francis sees the church's major activity, shifting from the sacristy to the real world.
Well, it certainly sounds like we're not going to see Pope Francis including women in the priesthood.
No, I don't think that will happen. Not in my lifetime. Not for a long, long time, if ever. And mainly because John Paul II wrote a very short document which essentially said, this is infallible teaching. The church cannot ordain women as priests. And for someone to come in and undo that so quickly, at least, without some new issues, some new thinking, that would be highly unusual. Where I think the church can make a move, however, and we'll see if the new pope is open to this, is women deacons, for example. And that has been proposed recently by the bishops of Germany. They have put this question on the table, that women could be ordained as deacons. And the role of deacons could be very important in the future of the church. We have a lot of male deacons right now who have a very active ministry, especially in places where there is a shortage of priests. And women deacons is a controversial question because there are some who say, no, that's almost like making women priests. And there are others who say, not at all, there were women deacons in the early church, and there's certainly, this could be a new ministry for the modern church.
I guess the other question that I have, and we've run out of time, so I've got to move on here, but I do wonder if there's any signals sent from the Roman Curia that gives latitude to parishes around the world to do it their way. I mean, there's been plenty of practices in the parishes which do not conform to the Vatican's way of doing business, but life goes on. And unless some cardinal or bishop in the area decides to crack down on it, there are all kinds of experiments going on out there. Is this pope likely to turn his eye away from what might be going on locally and allow some of this experimentation?
I think Pope Francis probably is less concerned with whether the rules are being bent. Yes, I think he has a much more flexible approach to pastoral life. I think we saw that in Argentina, where he was archbishop. He's a people person. He knows that local people are going to have their own ways of thinking. They're going to have their own sparks of inspiration and their own creativity in doing things and in inventing pastoral practices. And I think for a long time we've seen from Rome this attitude that, oh my gosh, if a local community does one little thing liturgically the wrong way, well, we better crack down on that because it could lead to something else. I think this new pope is going to be much less concerned about that, mainly because, as he said, he's less concerned about regulating the church's internal things and much more concerned about getting the church, and that means Catholics, out there talking about their faith.
John, we have to shut down the interview, but boy, have I enjoyed it, and I really enjoyed the book. I thought you told this story with expertise, objectivity, and most importantly, humor. I don't know whether that comes through in my questioning, but I must say I think our listeners will really enjoy the book, and the book is The Vatican Diaries, a behind-the-scenes look at the power, personalities, and politics at the heart of the Catholic Church. Thanks for joining us today at Reader's Corner.
Thanks so much for having me on.
I hope you enjoyed this encore edition of our interview with John Thavis. Next week, Gary J. Bass, author of The Blood Telegram, Nixon, Kissinger, and a Forgotten Genocide. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones. Research by Mike Journey. Our producer is Janelle Brown. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.